Shore Shame Podcast, shining a light to the nations.
Shalom, everybody. This is Bill Cloud, and this is our commentary on the Torah portion, Vayetze, and he went out. It's taken from Genesis or Bereshit, chapter 28, verse 10, and goes over to chapter 32, verse 3. And in this Torah portion, we're going to see that Jacob's flight from Esau placed him in the home of yet another crafty and deceitful person. Having left one, that is Esau, he's going to flee into a land that's going to put him under another deceitful person. And that, of course, is Laban or Laban. Laban is viewed as one who tried to uproot the nation of Israel because of all his craft and deceit and trying to keep Jacob in the land of Padan Aram. And so in anticipation of this, Jacob first goes and consults Shem and Eber. Now, this is according to Jewish tradition. But supposedly he went and consulted these two men, Shem, Eber, before going to Padan Aram, because both men had, in their time, had to cope with corruptive influences. Eber, of course, had to deal with the influence of Babylon. Shem had to do with the generation of the flood. Now, again, that's legend, that's tradition, but we shared it for whatever it's worth. But again, supposedly this kind of helped him prepare for his coming ordeal. And that is, again, not text, but I found it to be kind of an interesting concept. And quite frankly, I don't see that it would be a stretch to imagine that someone like Jacob, under the circumstances, would not try to find some counsel from somewhere. But whether it happened, whether it didn't happen, this is for sure. Jacob is fleeing Esau, and he is not going into a situation that is, on the surface anyway, going to be a good situation. But of course, we're going to see that the Creator was with him through the whole ordeal and brings him safely back into the land of his fathers. In this Torah portion, we're also going to see that a well will become the place where a bride is found, specifically the bride of a patriarch, because Eliezer, years before, had met Rebekah on Isaac's behalf at a well. Of course, he was not considered a patriarch, but Moses met Zipporah at the well. And ultimately, Yeshua met the Samaritan woman in John chapter 4 at a well. Of course, I believe that the Samaritan woman is a picture of those who are not regarded in ethnic terms as being Israel, but because of their heart and wanting to seek the God of Israel, are considered to be his people. And so in a sense, you could say that Yeshua met his bride at a well. A well is also seen as a depository of wisdom, because in the well, there's water. Water is likened unto life, but the water is concealed. It's buried underground. And so those who are determined to access wisdom, they have to assert themselves. They have to remove the obstacles. In this case, in our Torah portion, you'll see that that obstacle is a stone. Stones, we're going to see, play a large role in this Torah portion. In one case, a stone is going to hint at the fact that Jacob is the one who is going to take what up until this point in time had been a family, Abraham, Isaac, now Jacob. And he's going to transform that family into a nation, and a stone is going to play a big role in that. That stone is also going to hint that this particular nation, Israel, will only be sustained by the role of the Messiah, Yeshua. And we'll go into details of that as we move along here. We're also going to learn in this Torah portion that regardless of our circumstances and regardless of what's going on, even when our lives are being threatened, God is very near. He's not afar off, but he's at hand. Because when Jacob flees from Esau, that's when he encounters God at Bethel. Of course, this has to do with the dream of the staircase and the angels ascending and descending. And lastly, even though he was forced to leave the land, and that would symbolize the exile, but even though he was forced to leave the land, it would serve a purpose. And as that purpose unfolds, Jacob, Israel, is going to be protected and safely brought back into the land at the appointed time. So those are some of the things that we're going to address here in the Torah portion. Let's get into it now. In chapter 28, beginning at verse 10, the portion begins, "And Jacob went out from Beersheba and went toward Haran. And he went out," Vayetze is where we get the title of the Torah portion, "and Jacob went out," or "and he went out." In verse 11, it says, "and he lighted," or "encountered the place." Now, it's interesting that the text makes it clear that this is not a place. It is a specific place. And the place that he lighted upon is the place where Isaac had been bound, his father had been bound years before, and of course, where in the future the temple would stand. Now, the word "lighted upon," which is also rendered "encountered" in the Hebrew, is paga, it also means to entreat or to intercede. And so it hints at he interceded at the place, or he entreated God at the place. Again, the place where his father had been bound upon the altar. And so that implies that Jacob was seeking God for divine protection. And so he went to that particular place. And because this occurred at evening, the sun was beginning to set. And it's implied anyway that he entreated or he interceded on his own behalf, that Jacob is attributed with instituting what in Hebrew is called ma'ariv, or the evening prayer. Now at that time in verse 11, it tells us that he took one of the stones of the place and put it under his head. That's what a lot of translations will say, or he took one of the stones and put it under his head as a pillow or something to that effect. But we're going to break this down word by word here. First thing we're going to look at is the place. He took one of the stones of the place. In Hebrew, the place is hamakom, and it's using the definite article there, hey, or ha, pronounced ha, and that specifies the place. Once again, this is at Mount Moriah. This is where the temple would stand. And so he took a stone of that place, that particular place. Of course, this place already has an interesting history. And by the way, we cover that in detail in the Torah portion, Vayera. So we're not going to exhaust it here. However, just to kind of bring it into context and remember a few things, it was at this very place that Genesis chapter 22, verse 4 tells us, "On the third day, Abraham lifted up his eyes and he saw Hamakom afar off," or he saw the place afar off. Of course, that refers to the place that he was to take Isaac, but there are connotations to that. And when he saw the place afar off, apparently, Abraham saw something that he didn't reveal to anyone else. You remember, he turned to his servants and said, "You guys can wait here. Me and my son are going there to worship, but we are coming back to you," because he saw something that day that gave him the confidence that God will provide himself the lamb for a burnt offering. And so the rabbis determined that the spirit of prophecy came upon him and revealed something to him. And he saw something in the distance of time, which, by the way, is hinted at by the word merechok, or afar off. So the spirit of prophecy came on him as he saw the place. He sees something that no one else sees. He declares that God will provide himself the lamb for the burnt offering. And so the question is, what did Abraham see? And of course, I believe, and again, we teach about this in the Torah portion, the Yera, he saw Yeshua, because Yeshua said, "Abraham saw my day and he rejoiced." That's in John chapter 8, verse 56. And so when he says he saw my day, what day would he be referring to? I believe, because Abraham lifted up his eyes on the third day, that what he was seeing was the resurrected Messiah in his glory. So that's why he said God will provide himself the lamb for a burnt offering. According to Hebrews, he believed God would be obligated to raise Isaac from the dead should he have to slay him. That's in Hebrews chapter 11, verse 17. So all of this is to say that what Abraham saw, what he went through, all of it was to present a picture to us of the Messiah, Yeshua, that he is the promised seed raised from the dead. Remember, Abraham saw the lamb that God would provide on the third day. And so Abraham's trust in God's provision and Isaac's submission left a very powerful spiritual imprint on Mount Moriah. In fact, that's what prompted Abraham to call the name of the place Yahweh Yireh, or the Lord, he will see to it, or in the mount of the Lord it is seen. And so, again, all of this is to undergird Hamakom, the place is where all of this transpired and where Jacob went to. It's also important to remember that Hamakom, translated the place, is also a title that rabbinic commentary gives to the Creator because he's in every place. If I go up into heaven, you're there. If I make my bed in Sheol, you're there. So there is no place that we can go that he isn't already there. Therefore, he's not just in a place, he's in every place. And so consequently, he is the place. Again, all of this is just to emphasize that this is the place that Jacob came to at evening time as he is fleeing from Esau. So consider the context. He obviously knows what happened to his father. He obviously is aware of this place. I don't think it was happenstance. He's fleeing from Esau for his very life. And so he lights upon the place at evening. Now, just a footnote. It may be significant, it may be insignificant, but nevertheless, after Abraham left Mount Moriah, or the place, he returned, the Bible tells us, to Beersheba. It just so happens, at this particular instance, as Jacob is coming to the place, he is coming from Beersheba. And so Jacob comes to the place where Abraham saw the Lord afar off in time. And it is from this sacred place that Jacob takes one of the stones. Now, there's an alternate rendering that says, from the stones. But all of that is to imply that he took a stone. He didn't take multiple stones. In fact, Rashi, the Jewish commentator, says, the stone. In other words, emphasizing a particular stone, not just a random stone. Now, there are some other sources that suggest he gathered multiple stones, but they specify that it was exactly 12. And when he took these 12 stones, they formed one larger stone. But again, all of that is to say it was the stone. And if it was 12 stones, which hints at what Elijah did when he gathered the 12 stones to repair the altar of God that was broken down. And if they were to form one, then what that is signifying is the 12 tribes, of course, coming together as one nation, ultimately under Messiah. But at any rate, he took the stone. He took one stone, or he took stones that become one. And then it says that he placed it under his head for a pillow. Now, I want you to think about the way we've looked at this story or heard this story in times past. I want you to imagine you're on the run, you're tired, you come to a place, you see a stone, and you think, that would make a good pillow. I think I'm going to rest my head on a rock. Now, how logical does that seem to you? The word that gets translated as pillows is merashotav, and it's in plural form. That word can be translated as headpiece or headrest. Alternate renderings of this verse suggest it should be read this way, that he took the stone and he arranged it around his head or placed it at his head. In other words, rather than putting it under his head for a pillow, that he arranged it at his head. He placed it at his head. And that would seem logical that he placed it at his head rather than under his head. Yet, why would Jacob feel the need to place this rock or this stone at his head? If you go back to the previous Torah portion and remember the birth of Jacob, how when he was born, he placed his hand on Esau's heel, and I believe ultimately to protect his own head from Esau's heel. And we don't have time to develop that here. You can get the background of that in the Torah portion Toledot. But my point is, he would have been protecting his head from Esau's heel in Genesis 25 when he put his hand on his brother's heel. And so then, is it possible that Yaakov, meaning hand on heel, and implying someone who has to protect their head from their adversary's heel? Is it possible that the stone is placed at his head to conceal, even protect his head from his adversary, specifically Esau? And furthermore, the word Merashotav is plural, and it actually suggests heads rather than just a head. In other words, it was seemed to say that he took the stone of that place and he set it at his heads, plural. And so what would heads speak of? Here's what I believe. The 12 tribes of Israel. In other words, there is something that is literally happening in this story, but what is being played out in this story is a prophecy. Because Jacob, as we know, is going to become Israel through the 12 tribes. And that ultimately, that nation, as one nation, is going to come together under the headship of the Messiah. But in the meantime, the adversary is going to do everything in his power to try to destroy that nation. And so the stone is at his head to not only conceal him from his adversary, to shield him from his adversary, but to protect him from his adversary, and not just Jacob, but the 12 tribes of Israel. And so it suggests that the stone, and in the Hebrew, ha-evin would be the term, that the stone of the place, ha-makom, protects Jacob and his tribes. So that then leads us to this question. What is the stone? What is the significance of the Bible making it very clear that we understand it's ha-evin, the stone, not a stone? Isaiah 28 verse 16 says, "Therefore thus says the Lord God, behold, I lay in Zion for a foundation, a stone, a tried stone, a precious cornerstone of sure foundation. He that believes shall not be in haste." And so in Isaiah's prophecy, this foundation stone is a particular stone. Psalm 118 verse 22 says, "The stone that the builders rejected has become the cornerstone," which would connect us to the stone that's being referred to in Isaiah 28 verse 16. In Isaiah 8:14, it says this, "And he will become a sanctuary and a stone of offense and a stone of stumbling to both houses of Israel, a trap and a snare to the inhabitants of Jerusalem." So we take those prophecies, and then let's take a look at what the New Testament has to say of this stone. Here's what Peter says in 1 Peter chapter 2, verse 6 through 8. "For it stands in Scripture, behold, I am laying in Zion a stone, a cornerstone, chosen and precious, and whoever believes in him will not be put to shame. So the honor is for you who believe, but for those who do not believe, the stone that the builders rejected has become the cornerstone, and a stone of stumbling and a rock of offense. They stumble because they disobey the word, as they were destined to do." So in these few verses here, Peter takes all of the previous verses that we just read, and he identifies Yeshua the Messiah as being that stone. He is the cornerstone. He is the stone the builders rejected. He is the stone of stumbling and rock of offense. So if Peter says that he is the stone in these prophecies, I want to recommend to you that the stone that Jacob set at his head to, I believe, to shield his head, to guard his head, to conceal his head, and implying his heads, the tribes, is a picture of Yeshua the Messiah. Yeshua himself says this in Matthew 21, verse 42 and 44. He says, "Have you never read in the Scriptures, the stone that the builders rejected has become the cornerstone? This was the Lord's doing, and it is marvelous in our eyes." And then going down to verse 44, he says, "And the one who falls on this stone will be broken to pieces, and when it falls on anyone, it will crush him," alluding to the stone of stumbling and rock of offense. And so once again, the stone that Jacob placed at his head and or heads represents Yeshua, the Messiah, concealing, guarding Jacob and the tribes. In John chapter 11, verses 45 through 52, we read that the very reason Yeshua died was that he might bring the tribes together as one, those who were near, as Ephesians 2 would put it, and those who are afar off, not that nation only, but that he would gather together in one the people of God who were scattered abroad, is the way John chapter 11 puts it. So all of this happened, remember, where Abraham saw the Lord afar off in the distance of time. Let me put it to you this way. This all happened when Abraham on the third day saw my day, Yeshua said, and he rejoiced in it. He saw the risen Lamb, the one who God provides himself as a Lamb, the one who will bring the nation together as one, who will protect them, who will defend them, and who will lead them. And so Israel, through Jacob, encountered the Creator at the place where the promised seed, Isaac, who is a picture of the Messiah, was lifted up. So the stone that he placed at his head is ultimately projecting an image of the Messiah, Yeshua. Now, Judaism believes that this particular stone that Jacob took was the Evan Hashetiyah. Evan Hashetiyah, or the foundation stone. And just as a footnote, some people believe that this stone is still on the Temple Mount. The Midrash Tanhuma says this about the Evan Hashetiyah. As the navel is set in the center of the human body, so is the land of Israel, the navel of the world, situated in the center of the world, and Jerusalem in the center of the land of Israel, and the sanctuary in the center of Jerusalem, and the holy place in the center of the sanctuary, and the ark in the center of the holy place, and the foundation stone before the holy place, because from it the world was founded. In other words, they place a lot of emphasis on this foundation stone, that the foundation stone is essentially the center of everything. And I want to emphasize that, the center of everything, or shall we say, the focus of everything. Lo, I come, in the scroll of the book it is written of me, meaning the Messiah. So if the stone that Jacob set at his head is a picture of the Messiah, and if Judaism is correct, that the stone is also called the Heaven Hashetiyah, the foundation stone, then the foundation stone is a picture of the Messiah as well, and they believe that from it and by it the world was founded. It was at this place, the place, at the foundation stone, if you will, that Judaism believes that God gathered the earth that was formed into Adam. It was on this rock that Adam, Cain, Abel, Noah offered sacrifices to God. It's where Abraham placed Isaac on the altar. It's where the Ark of the Covenant rested. And they even believe that it was on this stone that God engraved his name Yud-Heh-Vav-Heh because he was going to set his name there at that place that we know as Mount Moriah. And so if the Evan HaShetiyah, the foundation stone, is a picture of the Messiah and his name Yud-Heh-Vav-Heh is upon it, well, that has implications as well. During Sukkot, there are prayers or references in prayers to the foundation stone. And one of them even says, Hoshena, Evan Hashetiyah, Hoshena. Or, please save, foundation stone, please save. Now, they're really crying out to the Creator to save us now. And you'll recall that when Messiah was coming in to Jerusalem, just days before his crucifixion, what were the people saying? Hoshena, Hoshena, Baruch haba b'shem Adonai. Save now, O Lord. Blessed is he who comes in the name of the Lord. Very interesting. All of that is to say that according to rabbinical belief, this is the stone that Jacob set at his head, and this is the stone that he would later anoint as a pillar, calling the place Bethel. And if this stone portrays Yeshua, and I'm convinced it does, it underscores that he is the beginning of the creation. He is the foundation stone. Here's something quite interesting. This particular stone that some believe still sits atop the Temple Mount has a small hole in the corner of it. And therefore, it's also called the pierced stone. Now, as we continue on into chapter 28, In verse 12, it tells us that after he lay down and went to sleep, he dreamed, and behold, a ladder set up on the earth, and the top reached heaven. Now, rabbis believe that this ladder, or this staircase, might be a better word, which, by the way, is the word sulam in Hebrew, samech lamed mem, that this staircase alludes to Sinai, which in Hebrew is samech yud nun yud. And one of the reasons they make this connection is because those two words, sulam, which is translated ladder or staircase, and the word Sinai, Mount Sinai, are numerically equivalent, 130. Because every Hebrew letter has a numerical equivalent. We're not going to teach all the details of that. But just to say that they connect these two terms. And so just as the Creator was on top of Mount Sinai speaking to his people, God is atop this staircase speaking to Jacob. And in verse 12, it goes on to tell us that, behold, the angels of God ascending and descending on it. Now, there's different ideas as what these angels represent. Some rabbinical sources suggest that angels represent the four kingdoms that were going to lord over Israel: Babylon, Greece, Medo-Persia, and Edom, equivalent to Rome. Others say that this is to signify how God directs earthly affairs. He is continually dispatching angels to the earth to carry out his will, and once they've done that, they're returning up to heaven to receive further instruction. But let me suggest that, well, maybe those are all correct, but in addition to that, and maybe ultimate to that, is this staircase, for all practical purposes, is a bridge between heaven and earth. And if it is a bridge between heaven and earth, that again speaks of the Messiah, because the Messiah is the one who connects and reconciles man back to the Creator, heaven and earth, if you will. Angels ascending and descending between heaven and earth also hints, as far as I'm concerned, at Proverbs chapter 30, verse 4, which says, "Who has ascended to heaven and come down? Who has gathered the wind in his fist? Who has wrapped up the waters in a garment? Who has established all the ends of the earth? What is his name? And what is his son's name? Surely you know." Now, what I want to get into here can be rather complicated. I hope to make it very simple, but springing off this ascending and descending concept, there is some rabbinical work that assigns a mysterious name to God that is linked to the idea of ascending and descending. And that secret name of God is spelled Lamed Kuf Yud. Don't ask me to pronounce that because I don't know, but it's Lamed Kuf Yud. And here's why, they say. Because the Lamed is the one letter in the Hebrew alphabet that ascends. The Kuf is the one letter in Hebrew that descends. And then the Yud, of course, is just suspended. So if you compare these three letters to the rest of the 22 letters, you'll see that they are distinct. Again, Lamed ascends, Kuf descends, the Yud is suspended. Now, I want to read to you from a book by Rabbi Yitzhak Ginsburg called The Aleph Beit about this so-called mysterious name of God. He says, and I quote, "The three letters of the Aleph Beit, each unique in its form, the suspended Yod, the ascending Lamed, and the descending Kuf spell a divine name. Together, they spell the mysterious name of salvation." That is, the mysterious name of Yeshua. This name derives from the initial letters of the three words of the only verse of Jacob's blessing of the tribes, the heads, that includes the name Yud-Heh-Vav-Heh. In other words, this is where they get this idea that these three letters are addressing this mysterious name of God. It's taken from Genesis 49, verse 18, which in English says, "I wait for your salvation, O Lord." And so in his blessing of the tribes, the heads, this is the only verse that uses the name Yud-Heh-Vav-Heh. And so that sends out a signal to pay attention to this verse. In Hebrew, the verse says, "Leshuotecha kiviti Yud-Heh-Vav-Heh," or the name of God. Again, "Leshuotecha," for your salvation, "kiviti," I am waiting, Yud-Heh-Vav-Heh. And so if you look at that in Hebrew, Leshuotecha begins with the ascending Lamed. Kiviti, the descending Kuf, And of course, the name of the creator begins with the suspended yud. So going back to what Ginsberg said, that's where they get the idea of this mysterious name. What is it alluding to? It is the mysterious name of salvation or Yeshua. So in Proverbs, the question is, who has ascended? Who has descended? Surely you know his name. What is his son's name? That's the question. And the rabbi would have us to say, or have us to believe, that Lamed Kuf Yud is revealing to us the nature of the name of salvation. Now Jacob, who saw angels ascending and descending, is awaiting God's salvation. He is seeking God to be delivered from his oppressor, his adversary. And so he sees these angels ascending and they are descending. And so rabbis look at this verse in Genesis 49 verse 18 as hinting at his name, which alludes to ascending and descending. Paul says this in Ephesians chapter 4. Therefore it says, when he ascended, represented by Lamed, on high he led a host of captives, and he gave gifts to men. In saying he ascended, what does it mean but that he had also descended, the Kuf, into the lower regions, the earth? He came from heaven, he descended from heaven, so to speak, to the earth, and then he ascended. So he who descended is the one who also ascended far above all the heavens that he might fill all things. Of course, Paul is obviously referring to the Messiah Yeshua, but what does he say? Before he ascended, he first descended. In other words, if we take this mysterious name of salvation, Lamed Kuf Yud, and we reverse the order, because if he ascended, that means he first descended, according to what Paul said. And so if we interchange or reverse the order of the Lamed and Kuf, then the result would be Kuf Lamed Yud. And Kuf Lamed Yud, descending, ascending, suspended yud, the result is in Hebrew koli. And koli literally means my voice. So who is my voice? Who is the one who descended and then ascended and who has sat on the right hand of God? By the way, yud represents a hand. It is my voice. It is my advocate. It is Yeshua, the Messiah. He is salvation. He is the salvation of Israel. He is the one that Jacob was waiting on. He is the one that you and I await. And so, on Mount Moriah, just to kind of underscore this, in Genesis chapter 22, verse 18, here's what God told Abraham at the place where he saw these things on the third day. He said to him, "And in your seed shall all the nations of the earth be blessed." Why? Because you have obeyed my Koli, my voice. You have obeyed me. You saw the Lord afar off in the distance of time. You saw the Lamb that God would provide. And that is what gave you the confidence to follow through and to obey my voice and to lift Isaac up onto that altar and Isaac to submit to the Father in this regard and to leave that very strong spiritual imprint at the place where I have set my name. And so all of these things weave together to show us that the Messiah Yeshua is being revealed in this story. And it's, as far as I'm concerned, painting a very, very complex but very simple picture that shows us that the Messiah is our salvation, that Yeshua is the King of Israel. He is the one who conceals, protects, and defends the tribes of Israel, and who will bring them back together as one nation and one people. And it is for him that we await. And to make this possible, he first descended that he might ascend. Now in verse 13, God is speaking to Jacob and he says, "The Lord said, I am the Lord, I am Yud-Heh-Vav-Heh, God of Abraham, your father, and the God of Isaac." And the Lord says this as he stands above the staircase. And again, he's revealing himself to Jacob in the place where God spoke to Abraham, which caused Abraham to say, "In the mount of the Lord, it shall be seen." That's Genesis 22, verse 14. But the word "it" is really implied, it could really be said that Abraham declared in the mount where the Lord is seen. And so this is the place that Jacob went to, the mountain where the Lord is seen. He goes on in verse 13 and he says, "The land whereon you lie, to you will I give it and to your seed." Now, this is something, even though Isaac blessed Jacob, this is something that Isaac could not do. He could not say, "This land is given to you and to your descendants." That is something that only God could affirm. And that's exactly what happened. And he did it in the place where he'd set his name. And that he promises this to Jacob while Jacob is lying on the Temple Mount is significant for many reasons. One of them is that today, that site is one of the most hotly contested pieces of real estate in the world to this very day. But God promised it to Jacob and to Jacob's seed. In verse 14, he says, "Your seed shall be as the dust of the earth and shall spread abroad." And spread abroad is literally to break forth. The Hebrew term is paratz, peresh zadeh, which literally means to break forth. And by the way, this is the same root word that is used in Micah chapter 2, which speaks of Jacob in the last days. Micah 2 verse 12 and 13. "I will surely assemble, O Jacob, all of you. I will surely gather the remnant of Israel, and I will put them together as the sheep of Bozrah, as a flock in the midst of their pasture. They shall make great noise by reason of the multitude of men. The breaker," in Hebrew that term is ha-poretz, from the same root word that's used here in Genesis chapter 28. "Ha-poretz, the breaker is gone up before them. They have broken forth," partsu, from the same root word, paratz, to break forth. "They have broken forth," that is the sheep of Bozrah, that is Jacob that has been assembled. "They have broken forth and passed on to the gate and are gone out by it. And their king is passed on before them and the Lord at the head of them," at the head of them. And so what this prophecy is saying is that in the last days, Israel is going to be gathered. He's going to bring all the tribes together as one. He's going to, as a shepherd, put them in a fold as the sheep of Bozrah. And there's going to be a lot of noise. And then the breaker, the one who breaks, has gone up before them. And they're going to break out, because that's what the kingdom of heaven does. And when they start breaking out, then their king is going to be passing in before them. And the Lord, because the Lord is the king, at the head of them, which is very striking, considering that Jacob set the stone at his head. So this prophecy in Micah 2, and the reason we're reading this is because of the term paratz, to break forth. Jacob is told that you and your seed are going to spread abroad, or literally break forth. So this prophecy in Micah 2 is what Yeshua alluded to when he said in Matthew 11, verses 11 and 12, "Truly I tell you, among those born of women, no one has appeared who is greater than John the Baptist." John the Baptist is the breaker. "Yet even the least important person in the kingdom of heaven is greater than he. From the days of John the Baptist until the present, the kingdom of heaven has been forcefully advancing," that is, breaking out, "and forceful men lay hold of it." And so the Messiah is alluding to Micah 2. Micah 2 is alluded to by what happens to Jacob, or what's told to Jacob, in that your seed is going to break forth. And so the point is, God told Jacob, Israel, that his descendants would break forth in all directions. And as a result of that, all the families of the earth would be blessed. It serves God's purpose that his descendants are scattered north, south, east, and west. That is a very critical aspect of the kingdom of heaven, and it is propagated by Jacob and his seed. But at the same time, the prophet declared that, like Jacob, as an individual, Jacob's seed would be gathered and that they would return to the land at the appointed time. And that is what the Father declared to Jacob on this particular night on the Temple Mount, which is, if Judaism is correct, the center of everything. And specifically, the stone that was at his head is the center of everything. the stone that was at that very time God was speaking to him was concealing and defending and guarding his head or his heads. In verse 15, God says to Jacob, I am with you and will keep you wherever you go, and I will bring you back to this land. And so again, that is not only speaking to Jacob as an individual, but that's also speaking to Jacob and to his seed. I will keep you wherever you go, and I will bring you back to this land because I'm the one who defends your heads. The term keep you is from the root word shamar, which literally means to guard, to protect. Again, the stone is at his head. And so Jacob would journey to Syria, and he later on in life, he would journey to Egypt. That's it. But what about his seed? They would go throughout the earth. His heads would be throughout the earth. And he promised, I will protect you wherever you go. I'll guard you wherever you may be, and I will bring you back into this land. And according to Micah 2, all of you, all of your people. He continues and says, and I will not leave you until I have done that which I have spoken to you of. Now, as far as I can detect, there is no record that God had spoken to Jacob directly before now. So could it be that he says, and I will not leave you until I have done that which I have spoken concerning you? And what had he spoken concerning Jacob? Well, he had told Abraham that in Isaac shall your seed be called. In Isaac. Not necessarily exclusively through Isaac, but in Isaac, hinting at Jacob. So Jacob's already been hinted at back when God was speaking to Abraham. That would be concerning Jacob. The land will be given to Jacob, Israel, not to Esau. And therefore, he is not to fear Esau, even though Esau wished to kill him and is plotting to kill him. He's also said the righteous seed is going to crush the head of the serpent's seed. Now, when did he say that? He said that back in the very beginning in Genesis chapter 3. And so that's something that concerns Jacob. And even though the adversary's attempt, and this is my opinion, very strong opinion I might add, the adversary's attempt or plan is to try to reverse that decision. In other words, instead of his seed being crushed by the righteous, he wants to crush the head of the righteous seed, specifically through Esau at this point in time, but that's ultimately going to fail. That's already been spoken of long before there was an Abraham, Isaac, or Jacob. And he's already said that Esau's destruction will in fact come at the hands of Jacob because his hand was on his heel. And the word heel, Akiv, also means end, implying that at the end, Jacob will rise, Israel will rise, and lord over Esau. So all of these things had been spoken concerning Jacob before this conversation with Jacob ever took place. Now in verse 16, it says that Jacob awoke and said, surely the Lord is in this place, and I did not know it. Because again, according to Deuteronomy 14:24, this is the place where he set his name. In verse 17, he was afraid and said, how full of awe, and that word is nora, how full of reverential fear is in this place, and this place is the Hebrew term hamakom. How full of awe and fear, reverence, is in the place. And he goes on and he says, this is the house of God and the gate of heaven. Judaism believes that this particular place is the portal through which men's prayers go up to heaven, that their prayers go to Jerusalem, so to speak, and once they get to Jerusalem, specifically the Temple Mount, that's when they go up into the heavens. Now, it is interesting that Daniel faced Jerusalem when praying, according to chapter 6, verse 10. It is interesting that the Shema is recited while facing Jerusalem. Is it a fact that our prayers go to Jerusalem and then up? I have no idea. I don't know. I would say this, that the Father, our Creator, is close. He's at hand. He's not a way off. So whether or not this is factual, I can't say, but we can say that Jacob identified this specific place as God's house and the gate of heaven. So in verse 18, it says that Jacob rose early and took the stone that was at his head and set it up for a pillar. Not a pillow, but a pillar. And so the stone that had protected his head and all that that signifies is the stone that he set up for a pillar. Now, it's believed that, by some anyway, that he did this more as a marker rather than an act of worship. Although, the scripture tells us that he poured oil on top of it and said, "This stone will be God's house." That's in verse 22. So the stone will be God's house, which, if the stone is referring to the Messiah. And when the Messiah asks his disciples, "Who do you say that I am?" And Peter says, "You are the Mashiach, the Son of the living God." He says, "Peter, flesh and blood didn't reveal this to you, but my Father is in heaven. And on this rock," which is that foundational truth, not speaking to Peter as being the rock, but the statement that Peter made, that Yeshua is the Messiah and the Son of the living God, "That on this rock," or shall we say, "on this stone, I will build my house. I will build my congregation. I will build God's house," so to speak. So the stone that protected his head during the night is set up as a pillar and anointed as a pillar. And he says, "This stone will be God's house," signifying, at least on the surface, that this would be the site of the future temple, thus Bethel or house of God, but again, alluding to the Messiah. Now, the word "poured" in pouring oil is yatsak, which is kind of interesting because it's spelled very similarly to the name Yitzhak. It's not the same concept, but I just found it very interesting that without the chet, it's identical to Yitzhak. But at any rate, Yatsak means to pour into a cast. It can also be the word that's used for a tube or a pipe, insinuating that the stone had an impression in it or a hole in it. And remember, the stone atop the Temple Mount that some people believe is Evan HaShetia, the foundation stone, they also call it the pierced stone because it has a hole in it. Nevertheless, he is identifying this stone, marking the stone, and distinguishing it from the other stones of the place. Now, the word is not used here, but the concept of anointing is mashach. Mashach, mem shen chet, from which we get Mashiach or Messiah. Mashach means to separate out, and it's separated out by smearing with oil. It's a similar concept, even though it's a different word. But later on, we'll see that this very word is used in identifying this stone. So he symbolically anoints the stone that is representing the Messiah at the place. And again, in verse 22, he says, "This stone shall be God's house." And I believe that alludes to the Messiah because the Messiah likened himself to the temple of God. He said in John chapter 2, verse 19, "Destroy this temple, and in 3 days I will raise it up." The Jews then said, "It has taken 46 years to build this temple, and will you raise it up in 3 days? But he was speaking about the temple of his body. In verse 19, it says, "And he called the name of the place Bethel." The name of the city was Luz at first. And so apparently, Jacob stayed on the outskirts of the city of Luz because chapter 19 of Genesis demonstrates the dangers of a stranger staying in the city when the three angels came into Sodom or Sodom. But at any rate, Beth-El is house of El or God. Luz is an almond or an almond tree. Verse 20, "And Jacob vowed a vow," which is the first recorded in Scripture. And so that's worth reading here. Genesis 28 verses 20 through 22, "If God will be with me and will keep me in this way that I go and will give me bread to eat and clothing to wear so that I come again to my father's house in peace, then the Lord shall be my God and this stone which I have set up for a pillar shall be God's house. And of all that you give me, I will give a full tenth to you." So as Jacob vows this vow, let's consider this, that not only is he speaking for himself, but he is also speaking prophetically on behalf of all of Israel. So in other words, when he says, if you'll keep me in the way that I go, as I'm breaking out north, south, east, and west, if you'll take care of my daily bread and provide for me like you provide for the lilies of the field, in order that I may come again to my father's house in peace, or that I might come back to the land from which I've been exiled, then the Lord shall be my God. Not if you do this, then I will do that. But if you accomplish this and you bring this to pass, then everybody will know that you are my God. And so coming again to my father's house speaks of the return of the exiles, delivered from the Assyrian, Levan, in Jacob's case, and the oppression of the Assyrian, but the oppression that all of his seed would experience throughout all these nations. And so Israel did build God's house on that spot, and he did give a tenth, and his children would also tithe. But what I want to emphasize here is not just what happens to Jacob as an individual, because what happens to the fathers is a portent for their children. So if we are given our daily bread, if he clothes us as he clothes the lilies of the field, all of that is to signify that he will also be faithful to bring us back into the land of our fathers in peace. Now, as we go on into chapter 29, we're going to see that Jacob meets Rachel at the well. In verse 1, it says, Jacob went on his journey and came to the land of the children of the east. And verse 2 and 3, as he looked, he saw a well in the field, and behold, three flocks of sheep lying beside it, for out of that well the flocks were watered. The stone on the well's mouth was large, and when all the flocks were gathered there, the shepherds would roll the stone from the mouth of the well and water the sheep, and put the stone back in its place over the mouth of the well. So the stone would have been on the well's mouth, obviously, to prevent people from falling in or children from falling in. It would also be there to keep the water from being contaminated. And according to the text, we see that it would typically take many men to remove the stone from the well's mouth in order that the sheep could be watered. Yet we're going to see in verse 10 that Jacob removes the stone unassisted. Now, considering that the water is viewed as life-giving, that also alludes to wisdom, and wisdom is equivalent to the Word of God. And so when the stone was removed, all that was concealed in the well, all the wisdom, all the life-giving attributes, the Word, if you will, when the stone was removed, all of that came forth. All those things that had been hidden were now being revealed. And when did it happen? When the stone was removed. Now, according to verse 8, they wouldn't take the stone off the mouth of the well until all the flocks were gathered, which in my mind anyway, takes us back to Micah 2 when he says, I will gather all of you. Now Jacob, after inquiring if the shepherds knew Levan and had knowledge of his well-being, they reply, it is well, and see Rachel, his daughter, is coming with the sheep. That's in verse 6. So in verse 7, Jacob is encouraging them to remove the stone and water the sheep because it's that time of day. But in verse 8, they say, well, we can't do that just yet. We typically wait for the others to arrive with their flocks. This way, the stone is only removed once, and all the sheep can be watered at the same time. And it's during this conversation that Rachel did come with her father's sheep. Now, if she had her father's sheep, and she had all of them, it would infer that Levan's flock was small. And that's important because later on, he's going to have numerous sheep and goats. That is, after Jacob has been with him. So she brings this presumably small flock. And in verse 10 and 11, it says, now as soon as Jacob saw Rachel, the daughter of Levan, his mother's brother, and the sheep of Levan, his mother's brother, Jacob came near and rolled the stone from the well's mouth and watered the flock of Levan, his mother's brother. Then Jacob kissed Rachel and wept aloud. So disregarding local custom, Jacob removes the stone himself, by himself. And of course, this is after a very long journey. He's weary, and yet he has this strength, apparently, to remove the stone. And so by watering the flock of his uncle, it hints again at the fact that Jacob, Israel, is a source of blessing. He removes the stone so that all of the blessing can come forth from the well. Now, the kiss that he gives Rachel is most likely a respectful kiss. It's a salutation, and it's between family. And he's weeping aloud. You know, he's been united with his family. Now, you compare what happens here to what happens when Eliezer came looking for Isaac's wife. Abraham's servant Eliezer is laden down with gifts to give his kinsman. But Jacob doesn't appear to be in that same situation. He appears to have nothing with him, really. Perhaps thinking that Jacob is going to come bearing all of these gifts too, when Laban hears that his kinsman has come, Laban remembers what Eliezer came with, all the gifts. And so we see that in verse 13, Laban comes running to meet Jacob when he hears that he's in town. Verse 13 says, when Laban heard the tidings, he ran to meet him and embraced him and kissed him. Now that is remarkably different from the treatment that he's going to give Jacob later on, which kind of again hints that maybe the reason Laban came running at first was he was expecting to be showered with gifts, because that's the kind of person Laban was. Now apparently, Jacob serves Laban for about a month for no wages. So finally, Laban says in verse 15, shall you serve me for nothing? Tell me what your wages will be. Now apparently, based on the answer that he's going to give, Jacob had already been thinking about this, and he tells Laban that his wage will be Laban's daughter Rachel as a wife. Now in verse 16, the text points out to us that Laban had two daughters, Leah the older and Rachel the younger. And it says that Leah's eyes were weak, which is to say tender, softened, but it's not necessarily a negative term. It says that Rachel was a beautiful form and fair to look upon. And so what it seems to be saying is this, that Leah was plain. She was a plain Jane. She was not someone that just stood out in a crowd necessarily. But it's not painting her in a negative light. It's saying that, apparently, in comparison to Rachel, because while Leah was plain and yet pleasant, Rachel was stunning. So if that's the case, then what this text tells us is that Jacob fell for the better looking of the two. But she's also the one who later on will steal Laban's idols. So even though it says that Leah's eyes were weak and Rachel was very beautiful and fair to look upon, does it also, by the fact that Rachel will steal Laban's idols later on, does that imply that Rachel was weak in areas that you could not see? That Leah's weakness perhaps was very plain to see on the surface, but her strengths were hidden, whereas Rachel's strengths were very easy to see, but her weaknesses were not. Something to consider. Verse 18 says, Jacob loved Rachel and said, I will serve you 7 years for Rachel, your daughter. Of course, this was agreeable to Laban, and he says, it's better that she marry a relative than to marry a stranger. So verse 20 tells us that Jacob served 7 years, and they seemed like a few days because he loved her so. And at the end of the 7 years, he goes to Laban to receive Rachel. Laban makes a feast, putting on the face that he is going to keep his word to Jacob. But obviously, he's already been plotting, because he took Leah, heavily veiled, and presumably under the cover of darkness, he takes her to Jacob's tent. And in verse 25, it tells us, and it came to pass in the morning that, behold, it was Leah. Now, we could ask the question here. Was this retribution for the deceit that Jacob, even though he was forced into, went ahead and followed through on? That is, with his father Isaac. Because there's no doubt, in my mind anyway, that Leah was probably forced into this, given Laban's nature. And it seems illogical to consider that Jacob would not have detected this beforehand. And so then, was this supposed to happen? Was this what God had purposed? You see, Jacob's, or shall we say, Israel's expectations were to be joined to the stunning one, the one who was very beautiful and fair to look upon, not the tender one, even though Leah was Jacob's primary wife, giving him as many sons as the other three combined. And of course, it's Leah, not Rachel, who is buried with Jacob at Machpelah. Yes, Rachel produced Joseph, and Joseph saved Israel from famine, but Leah produced Levi, who gave us the priesthood, and Judah, the Davidic line. But even though she gave all these children to Jacob, still, this was not the one he was looking for. You see, he was, shall we put it this way, looking for Joseph. He was looking for the stunning one, the powerful one. He wasn't looking for the weak-looking one, the tender one, the soft one. And so I'm saying that for this reason. Does this allude to Israel's expectations of the Messiah? Because when Israel first beheld him, they were not overly impressed. In fact, Isaiah 53, verse 2 and 3 may hint at this. For he grew up before him as a tender plant, and as a root out of a dry ground. He has no form nor comeliness. And when we see him, there is no beauty that we should desire him. May I say, he looks more like Leah. He was despised. Leah was despised in comparison to Rachel. He was despised and rejected of men, a man of sorrows and acquainted with grief. And as one from whom men hide their face, he was despised, and we esteemed him not. Luke chapter 24, verse 21, two of the Messiah's disciples even said this, but we hoped that it was he who should redeem Israel. But when they said that, they were troubled by the events of the last few days and really didn't know what to think. So when Israel encounters the Messiah at first, they come to the conclusion, this is not the one we were looking for. In the morning, so to speak, behold, it was Leah. However, when he returns, they will be in awe of him. Revelation 19, verses 11 through 13. And I saw the heaven open, and behold, a white horse, and he that sat thereon called Faithful and True. And in righteousness he does judge and make war. And his eyes are a flame of fire, and upon his head are many crowns. And he has a name written which no one knows but he himself. And he is arrayed in a garment sprinkled with blood, and his name is called the Word of God. So when he returns, his eyes are not soft, weak. His eyes are a flame of fire. Now, verse 25, Jacob says to Laban, what is this that you have done to me? Why have you beguiled me? At this point, Laban's response is to shift responsibility. He's going to lay it off on the expectations of the community. We don't do this in our land. The firstborn has to be married first. And so Laban defaults to flesh in choosing the firstborn, which is compared to Jacob, who wasn't the firstborn of the flesh, but he is the firstborn. He's the one worthy of being the firstborn. But anyway, Laban says in verse 27, fulfill her week, and we will give you the other if you serve me 7 more years. And so he's going to get 7 more years of work out of him. And here's perhaps the very reason he pulled this fast one on Jacob. Because Jacob for 7 years has been working very hard, very diligent, and Laban is prospering because of it. So fulfill her wedding week, that is of Leah's, and not repudiate her. And if you do that, then I'll give you the other one as a wife, but you got to serve me 7 more years so I can be blessed and prosper an additional 7 years. So at the end of the wedding feast, which lasts 7 days, then Jacob's going to marry Rachel and then begin the process of paying for her, something he had not intended to do. Nonetheless, in verse 28, Jacob agrees. He marries Rachel at the end of the 7-day wedding feast. And this, in exchange for 2 wives, which he didn't plan on, Jacob works for Laban 14 years. Now, footnote here, after the giving of the Torah at Sinai, marrying 2 sisters is forbidden. And just reading this story, we would understand why. Not only does he have 2 wives, but in the course of the story, he is going to be given 2 handmaids, Zilpah and Bilhah, who will become wives. And Zilpah and Bilhah, of course, were given as maidservants to Laban's daughters, Leah and Rachel. In verse 30, it says that he went into Rachel, and he loved Rachel more than Leah. Now, let's keep in mind that he had not intended to marry Leah. That came through the deceit of her father. But he labored another 7 years, knowing what his uncle had done to him. And so perhaps that enters into Jacob's thinking. This is not what I agreed to. Nevertheless, I'm in this situation. I'm just going to have to make the best of it. But in verse 31, it said, "The Lord saw that Leah was hated, and he opened her womb." As if to say, because you are less loved than Rachel, who was being preferred by Jacob, I'm going to open your womb. Now, when it says hated, it doesn't really mean that he hated her, despised her, because we're going to see he didn't mistreat her. And later on, not only does he bring Rachel into a conversation that's very important, but he brings Leah into a conversation that's very important as they are about to depart and go back to the land of Canaan. So when it says that she's hated, it's not that he despised her. It's just that he preferred Rachel. Rachel was the one that he wanted. Leah was the one he got. Then, later on, he got Rachel. But Rachel was barren. So in this area, Rachel, who was stunning, was weak. And Leah, who was perceived as having weak eyes, was strong. Verse 32 tells us that Leah bore a son and called him Reuben, or Reuven. Why? Because the Lord has seen my affliction. Because Reuben literally means see a son. So the Lord saw my affliction, and so consequently, here's a son. As evidence that God is looking on my affliction, because I didn't ask to be in this situation either. My father forced me into this situation. And with his birth, Leah feels that Jacob will begin to prefer her since Rachel is barren. But this was not to be because he continued to prefer Rachel. And later on, he preferred Rachel's firstborn son, Joseph, which raises a very interesting point, seeing that Joseph inherited the birthright, that is the double portion. Because we're told in Deuteronomy chapter 21, verses 15 through 17, if a man have two wives, one beloved and another hated, and they have borne him children, both the beloved and the hated, which fits the scenario that we're discussing here. And if the firstborn son be hers that was hated, this would be Reuben in this case, then it shall be when he makes his sons to inherit that which he has, that he may not make the son of the beloved firstborn before the son of the hated. In this particular case, it would seem to be saying that Jacob could not make Joseph, who was the firstborn of the beloved, ahead of Reuben, the firstborn of the hated, because the one of the hated is indeed the firstborn. But he shall acknowledge the son of the hated for the firstborn, giving him a double portion of all that he has. In this case, once again, that would be Reuben. For he is the beginning of his strength. The right of the firstborn is his. So then, how is it that Joseph was given the double portion and the birthright ahead of Reuben? How did Jacob justify that? 1 Chronicles chapter 5, verse 1 says, "Now the sons of Reuben, the firstborn of Israel, for he was the firstborn, but for as much as he defiled his father's bed, his birthright was given unto the sons of Joseph, the son of Israel, and the genealogy is not to be reckoned after the birthright." In other words, because Reuben messed up, and similarly, but not identically, like Esau, through his actions proves that he's not worthy of the birthright, because he, in Genesis chapter 35, verse 22, goes and lays with Bilhah, who is actually a wife to Jacob. Now, it's interesting to compare Reuben and Esau, because both did lose the birthright. However, when Esau lost it, and he lost the blessing, he wished to kill Jacob. That's in Genesis 27, verse 1. But when Reuben loses it, and it goes to Joseph, Reuben doesn't try to kill Joseph. In fact, he tried to save Joseph in chapter 37. So there is a distinction there. In verse 33, it says that Leah conceives again. She gives birth to Simeon, which his name means has heard, or God has heard. And he saw first and gave me Reuben, and now he's heard that I'm hated and has given me Simeon or Shimon. Verse 34, she gives birth to a third son. And she says, my husband will be joined unto me. And that son is named Levi. Levi. Now, the Midrash says that Levi was actually named or called by God, because later on, Levi would be the priesthood. But Leah says, my husband will be joined to me. Now, that's very interesting because phonetically, Lamed Vav Yud Levi is related to the Hebrew Lamed Bet, which is the word Lev or heart. She's saying, my husband will be joined to me. His heart is going to be for me. So, Lamed Vav Yud Levi, the name of the son, is related to Lamed Bet Yud, also pronounced Levi, which means my heart. In verse 35, Leah gives birth to Yehuda, or Judah, Yud He Vav Dalet He, saying, this time I will praise the Lord. Now, in the name Yehuda, it contains the sacred name of God, Yud He Vav He, just the Dalet is added to it. But it also contains the root word Hod, and Hod means thankfulness. And so what she's saying is, I am going to express thankfulness to Yud He Vav He, thanks to God. Now, a footnote to this particular verse here, Yehuda or Judah gives birth to Yehudim or Jews. And Chidushe Haurim, a commentary, notes that Jews are called Jews, Yehudim, because of Yehuda, Judah. In other words, they're called Jews because of Judah, not the other tribes. And that speaks to another topic for another time, perhaps, but it is, I believe anyway, proof that while the world regards Israel as being equivalent to Jews and vice versa, the scripture and this commentator makes it very clear that Jews are a selective group of Israel. They're Jews because of Judah, those who came from that tribe. Now, as we continue on into chapter 30, we see that Jacob's family is going to multiply, it's going to increase, which is prophetically significant because Jacob, Israel, multiplied outside of the land of Canaan. Only Benjamin was born in the land. Later on, Israel is going to multiply in Egypt, outside of the land. They're going to go from 70 people to approximately 2 to 3 million people. And so again, prophetically, Israel has multiplied in the nations. Remember, he says, you will break forth. You'll go to the south, the north, the east, the west. And yet at the same time, it says, at the appointed time, you will return to the land. Now, in verse 1 of chapter 30, it says that Rachel envied her sister and said to Jacob, give me children or I will die. Because this death that she's talking about would come from the grief of not giving children or not having children and the shame that's attached to a woman who's barren. There's a stigma attached to it. And so later on, we see that she is, in order to have children, going to revert to Sarah's methods. That is, giving the handmaid as a wife to conceive for her. But in verse 2, Jacob's very angry with her and he's saying, you know, am I in God's stead? It's not my fault that you can't have children. I'm not the one who can give you children. It's not within my power. Now, the Midrash notes that, unlike his father Isaac, Jacob did not pray for Rachel, or at least it does not record for us that he prayed on Rachel's behalf. The difference would be that Isaac only had one wife. Jacob has, at this point in time, two. And one of those wives has already given him four sons, so perhaps he doesn't feel the need to do that. The reason we're bringing this out is because we're going to see that this is going to prompt Rachel to pray on her own behalf. And she will eventually be given children in response to her prayers. Nonetheless, she reverts to the methods of Sarah. And in verses 3 through 5, Bilhah, the handmaid, is given to Jacob to take as a wife. And Bilhah gives birth to Dan, or Dan. In verse 6, this prompts Rachel to say, God has judged me. He has heard my voice and given me a son. And she calls him Dan, because that means to judge. In verses 8 and 9, Bilhah conceives again. she gives birth to Naphtali. Naphtali's name conveys the wrestling and the scheming that's going on between these two sisters to procure Jacob's favor. At least the scheming is very evident on Rachel's part. So, as a result of that, in verse 9, we see that Leah gives her handmaid, Zilpah, to Jacob. But keep this in mind, Leah's not barren. Sarah was barren. Rachel was barren. Leah is not. So we would presume that if Rachel hadn't done this first, then Leah would have never done it because it's going to bring a rival into the family. But seeing that Rachel's done it, well, you know what? I've left off giving birth to children, so I'm going to do this too. And so again, there's a lot of struggle. There's a lot of maneuvering and scheming between these two sisters who also happen to be the wives of the same man. It's a very dysfunctional family, to put it mildly. So in verse 10 and 11, we see that Zilpah conceives. She gives birth to Gad, which means fortune. She gives birth to Asher, which means happy, verses 12 and 13. And then we come to verses 14, 15, and 16, which gives us one of the most mysterious instances in Scripture. That is Reuben and his mandrakes, or Dudaim. Because it tells us in verse 14 that Reuben, in the time of the wheat harvest, he goes into a field and he finds Dudaim, or these mandrakes. Everything I've studied, it does not seem that anyone is absolutely certain of what these mandrakes or Dudaim were. One translation actually puts it that they were love apples. Because for whatever reason, whatever they were believed to have fertility-inducing powers. And apparently, Reuben thinks they do, Leah thinks they do, and Rachel certainly thinks they do. So that would beg the question, was this kind of some kind of superstition that the people who lived in Padan Aram had? Was it some kind of pagan thought or mindset? Don't know for sure. But if these Dudaim were believed to induce fertility, and by this time, Leah, according to the text, had stopped conceiving, this is evidence that the children are now getting involved in this struggle. That is Reuben. They're getting involved in the struggle that's going on between these two sisters, because apparently Reuben surmises that his mother wishes to have more children because she's the hated one. Of course, ironically, Reuben is eventually going to lose the birthright to Joseph, who is the son of Rachel. But anyway, in verse 14, Rachel comes and says, "Please give me some of your son's Dudaim," or mandrakes. Now, obviously, Rachel feels that they have the ability to help her have children, or she wouldn't ask. So Leah's response is, "Wasn't it enough that you took my husband, and now you want these?" So as far as Leah's concerned, Rachel is acting as if she's someone who's entitled to whatever she wants. Rachel's the stunning one. Leah is the plain, tender one. But we need to also point out that Rachel is the one that Jacob wanted in the first place, and Leah wouldn't be in this situation were it not for the plotting of her father. At any rate, in verse 15, Rachel said, "He," that is Jacob, "shall lie with you tonight for your son's Dudaim." In other words, he's supposed to be in my tent tonight, but if you give me some of your son's mandrakes, then he can go to your tent. Now, Rachel knows that Leah has stopped having children, so perhaps she's thinking nothing's going to come of her being with Jacob tonight. I'll have an opportunity to have children. That's the plan, but we see that her plan backfires because Leah conceived. It says in verse 17 that God hearkened unto Leah, and she conceived and bore a son. So Rachel presumably is relying on the Dudaim to have children. Leah gives them to Rachel, but God hearkens to Leah, and she conceived and bore a son, and she called him Yisachar. God has given me my hire, because she tells Jacob, "You got to come stay with me because I've hired you." Here's what I glean from this. God responded to prayer, not Dudaim, not superstition. Rachel didn't conceive because of the Dudaim. And so perhaps the point of this whole episode is to prove that, number one, God alone is in control of Israel's destiny, not potions, not schemes, whether they be on behalf of Israel or Israel's adversaries. God alone is in control. Charms and superstitions have no power where God's people are concerned. And that we, as His people, are to look to Him and Him alone, to seek Him in prayer for the answers to our problems and to our concerns. In verse 19 through 20, Leah gives birth to yet a sixth son, and they name him Zebulun, which means abode, because Leah believes that this son, this sixth son, will convince Jacob that he should dwell with her permanently. And then in verse 21, she gives birth to a daughter by the name of Dinah, and the reason that's mentioned is because there's an episode concerning her later on. But let's read verses 22 through 24. And God remembered Rachel, and God hearkened to her and opened her womb. And if He hearkened to her, then obviously by this point she has forgotten the Dudaim, and now she's praying. And she conceived and bare a son and said, God has taken away my reproach. And that term there in Hebrew, taken away, is Asaph. He has taken away my reproach. And she called his name Yosef, or Joseph, and said, the Lord shall add Yosef to me another son. And so what she says here, he has taken away my reproach, he will add to me another son, is the basis for the name Joseph, because it has a double meaning. He's taken away her reproach, and he's adding to her another son, something to be happy about. So she acknowledges in the name Joseph what God has done and believes God for what He will do. Now, thinking prophetically, Joseph's story reminds us of what He did for Israel in Joseph's day. But Joseph's story is also demonstrating to us what He will do for Israel in the future, specifically the restoration of the kingdom to Israel, the two becoming one. Interestingly, according to tradition anyway, Joseph was born on Yom Teruah. And verse 25 tells us that after the birth of Joseph, Jacob said to Laban, send me away to my own country. So apparently the 14 years expired soon after Joseph's birth. And in verse 26, he says to Laban, give me my wives and children that I have served you for, implying that Laban had some kind of control in some way. In verse 27, Laban says, I have observed the signs, and the Lord has blessed because of you. Now, either this was just something that was obvious to him and to everybody else, his flocks, his herds had grown since Jacob had arrived, or he observed signs through occultic means, and considering that he had gods, that wouldn't be a stretch. But either way, he acknowledged that he was blessed because of Jacob's presence, and so consequently, he doesn't want Jacob to leave. Now, Jacob, Israel's mandate is to be a blessing to the nations. Nations are blessed when God's people are among them, but the nations are not to hold God's people when it's time for them to return to their own land. At this point, it's not time for them to return, which is kind of an interesting thing to consider. In advance of when it was definitely time for him to return to the land, he was already wanting to return to the land. But he can't get ahead of God. So in verse 27, Laban says, if I have found favor in your eyes, which is going to imply that he wants Jacob to stay, it seems that he might be trying to make Jacob feel guilty. He wants to compel him to stay because he's going to insinuate that we've been blessed while you're here, and if you leave, it's going to bring calamity. It may even bring poverty upon your relatives. So Laban asks Jacob to name his price for remaining with him. Now, Jacob answers in a way that indicates that he has no reason to feel guilty. He has been very, very hardworking and tenacious when it came to keeping Laban and his flocks and his herds. To the contrary, Laban has been the one who's been taking advantage of him. But Jacob makes it very clear to him, the time has come for me to take care of my own family. And so he says in verse 29 through 30, you yourself know how I have served you and how your livestock has fared with me. For you had little before I came, and it has increased abundantly, and the Lord has blessed you wherever I turned. But now, when shall I provide for my own household? So in response to this, Laban asks, "What shall I give you?" And Jacob replies, "Nothing, but here is what I want to do. If I'm going to stay here, here's what we're going to do." And thus begins a very strange series of events. In verses 32 through 34, Jacob agrees to stay and to work for Laban in an agreement that, on the surface, would seem to favor Laban and would put Jacob at a disadvantage. It was so out there. But what's going to happen is Jacob is going to outwit Laban, and he's going to do it by really indulging Laban's tendency to cheat Jacob. In other words, Jacob had him agree to something that seemed ridiculous and would clearly put Jacob at a disadvantage, which favors Laban's tendencies. However, Laban did not take God's favor upon Jacob into account the way he should. The main points of the agreement are this. Jacob tells him, "I don't want you to give me any of your flocks that you possess. What you have now that has come as a result of my working for you, that's yours. I don't want any of that. But my wage will be the unnaturally colored animals that are going to be born in the future." So Laban removes all the unnaturally colored animals from the flock because he doesn't want those to reproduce. He removes those from the flocks and he leaves with Jacob only the ones that were naturally colored. They weren't speckled or grizzled or striped or what have you. So of those who are naturally colored that Jacob is going to care for, the ones that will be born that are unusually colored, those are the ones that Jacob gets to keep. And in fact, if there are any naturally colored animals that are in Jacob's flocks, they would be considered as being stolen. So here's what Laban is thinking. He's going to be left with the naturally colored animals. Highly unusual that they would produce a great number of unusually colored animals. It's going to be minimum. And so this is going to put Laban in a very advantageous situation. He likes that. That fits his personality. He loves to take advantage of Jacob. So in verse 35 and 36, Laban took the uniquely colored animals and then journeyed 3 days away from Jacob and the flocks that remained with him to make sure that the two groups couldn't mingle. Again, accentuating Laban's character. Now, later on, Jacob is going to accuse Laban of changing his wages multiple times. In other words, he's going to take advantage of people. He doesn't think anything of allowing people to work hard to build his house, his wealth, his kingdom. And if he could take advantage of them in the process, all the better. So in verses 37 and 38, knowing this, Jacob takes measures to protect himself from his uncle's schemes in order to retain what is his. What Jacob demonstrates here is that in dealing with the ungodly, one should not resort to their methods. Don't be like them. However, there isn't anything wrong with outwitting them as long as it's with integrity and honesty and not to get into unlawful practices. So here's what Jacob did. It was a three-pronged plan. Because according to Ecclesiastes, a threefold cord is not easily broken. He took rods of poplar and almond and he made them to look streaked and peeled. And he would set them before the ewes when the ewes would come to drink. And when they come to drink, this is when the males would come to impregnate them. And they would see these streaked and peeled rods. It would cause them to startled and then they would be impregnated. And supposedly this would enhance the possibilities of them giving birth to streaked and spotted animals or offspring. And then the second part of it was, once these spotted or streaked animals were born, he would separate them from the others that were naturally colored. In fact, he would have the spotted walk before the naturally colored, and that was in turn to influence the naturally colored to bear spotted offspring. And then the third part of it was the stronger animals, when they came to drink and it was time to mate, that's the ones he would set the rods before. And the weaker ones, he wouldn't do that. So that was to build a sturdier flock for himself and give the weaker ones to Laban. Now, later on, it becomes clear that Jacob was doing this because he had had a vision. And at this point in time, he had not revealed the vision to anyone else. As a result of his plan, his flocks were numerous and they were stronger. Laban's were weaker. And through this process, and over the 6 years, Jacob amassed great numbers of livestock, sheep and goats, etc. Now, here is something that's kind of a sidebar. I found it very interesting, and it's a comment that's made in some rabbinic literature that basically says this. If this text is suggesting that the offspring of sheep and goats can be influenced by something visual, does the same hold true for human beings? And if so, that would suggest very strongly that when a man and a wife come together to procreate, that they should in no way be influenced by any external forces, impure thoughts, third parties, etc. And I'll leave it at that. Because if this story is faithfully demonstrating that outer influences can affect offspring, then to allow impure thoughts, to allow these unclean things to come into our minds, to be visual in the act of procreation, may affect the soul and the nature of that child. And that should be a very, very scary thought to those who are not believers. Well, even to those who are. It's a very, very interesting comment. Now, as we continue in chapter 31, Jacob is going to flee from Laban. In verses 1 through 3, it says, "Now Jacob heard that the sons of Laban were saying, 'Jacob has taken all that was our father's, and from what was our father's, he has gained all his wealth.' And Jacob saw that Laban did not regard him with favor as before. Then the Lord said to Jacob, 'Return to the land of your fathers and to your kindred, and I will be with you.'" So Jacob had worked for Laban for 20 years very faithfully, and now he's hearing all these slanderous and accusing remarks. And he saw that the blessing that he had been bestowed with has now provoked Laban and his family to jealousy. He sees this contempt coming from Laban's countenance. So they are falsely accusing Jacob of being a supplanter, which is what Esau did. "He's taken all that was our father's." Esau said, "He took my birthright and my blessing." Cain, Pharaoh, Abimelech, many others throughout the Bible did the very same thing. They always became jealous of God's favor upon the righteous. Now, Laban couldn't accuse Jacob of breaking the deal. He agreed to the deal. And in fact, he had tried his best to work the deal in his favor. And yet, Jacob is growing and multiplying and being blessed. And so he could not hide his ill feelings toward Jacob. Now, there is a similar sentiment in today's world as well. It's always been this way. You look at the Israeli-Arab conflict, the Palestinian issue. It's the same thing. It's different circumstances, perhaps, but it's the same spirit. I'll even say this so-called Occupy movement, the 99%, it's the same spirit. Jealous of what the other has. At this point, God begins to speak to Jacob about returning. In other words, 6 years before, it wasn't quite the time, but now it's very clear the time has come. And that tells me that God makes it uncomfortable for his people when it's time for them to move, when it's time for them to go to the land. And so prophetically speaking, considering Israel at large, accusations and contempt will come from the people around us. And that is what will let us know that the time to leave is approaching. Verse 4 through 6, Jacob called Leah and Rachel into the field to speak to them privately before they depart. And so it's noteworthy that Jacob did not make this final decision until he consulted with his wives, which kind of gives you insight into how the scripture views the female and how a man should view his wife. She's not beneath him. She's beside him. And she should be considered in these situations. You do not default to her leading, but you bring her into whatever's going on. And so as he's having this conversation with them, he points out that they knew how hard he had worked on Laban's behalf. But wisely, he lays out the facts of the matter before he explains his decision. Now, here's a comment made in the Stone edition of the Torah. It says that God's tests are always calibrated to correspond to the strength of the person being tested. In this case, Jacob, all he had to do was hear God's command in light of his present circumstances. He had been ready to go 6 years before. Now he's convinced it's time to go, and he hears God's command to go. However, he took the time to explain the practical issues of their situation to his wives because they didn't hear the command of God. So he was very considerate of his wives, not just Rachel, but Leah as well. They're leaving the only home they've ever known, and so he wants to lay out the facts of the matter. He says in verse 7, "Your father has mocked me and changed my wages 10 times. Now this statement is going to be backed up later. He confronts Laban to his face, and Laban does not deny the charge. He has changed my wages these 10 times in spite of the fact that I've been a faithful and a hard worker. He's the one who's taken advantage of me, and you know it. But you also see that God did not allow him to harm me, which would infer we can trust God's command. In fact, in verse 9, he says, God has taken away the cattle of your father and given them to me. We're the favored family here. He's not. God has taken what belonged to your wicked father and has given it to me. Proverbs 13:22 says, a good man leaves an inheritance to his children's children, but the sinner's wealth is laid up for the righteous. In verses 10 through 13, Jacob then begins to relate the dream of the speckled goats and why he made the arrangement that he did with Laban. And he refers to the angel of God, which is used interchangeably as God. And in this dream, the angel of God points out to Jacob the speckled goats. And so God was letting him know that the speckled goats are going to be what you need to focus on. That this is what's going to happen. And the reason it's going to happen, the reason these sheep and goats are going to produce this speckled offspring, is because of what Laban has done. So that hints at this possibility, that the peeled rods were completely unnecessary. So then, if that's the case, then why do it? And some would suggest it was simply Jacob's attempt to conceal God's handiwork in all this. I won't be dogmatic about that. I don't know, but that's what it seems to be saying, that this is what's going to happen. So you need to make this arrangement. Hint, hint, wink, wink. For me, what all this is to say is prophetically, it is hinting at miraculous intervention on the behalf of God's people. When you see this miraculous intervention, when you see a situation that defies all probability, you'll know it's me, and that will precipitate your departure. That will bring about your leaving to go back to the land of your fathers. In this dream, verse 13, God speaks to Jacob and says, I'm the God of Bethel where you made a vow. So now's time to get out of this land. It's time for you to go home. I'm the God of Bethel where you anointed a pillar. And literally that term there, pillar, is a standing stone. Remember the stone. And the word anointed is mashachta. Mashachta. Mashach being the root from which we also get the noun Mashiach. So here we go back to that stone, which he had set at his head, but on the morning after he stood it up, it became a standing stone. And he anointed it, mashachta, he set it apart. And so that alludes once again to the Messiah Yeshua. But he brings it out that you made a vow. So now in keeping your vow, you must leave this place and you must return to your homeland. So Jacob is relating all of this to Leah and Rachel. And in verses 14 through 16, they acknowledge that they are no more than strangers in their father's house. We don't get to share in our father's wealth. They have no lot in his house. Their future is with Jacob. And so they support him in the decision to leave. So then in verses 17 and 18, Jacob gathers all of his belongings, his flocks, his herds, and he does it without stealth. And that's very important because he does not want to be perceived and viewed as a supplanter, as a deceiver, as a trickster. He does, however, outwit Laban, but he does it honestly because Laban had gone to shear his sheep, and that was a process that would take several days. And so he leaves when Laban's not around. However, in verse 19, it says, and Rachel stole the teraphim. that were her father's. And these were believed to be gods of protection, gods of good fortune, and Levon calls them my gods. Now the root word for teraphim is rapha, resh fe aleph. And that's a term that suggests mending or healing. But it's also the root word for raphaim, which is giants. And we won't go into that, but just kind of an interesting connection. A related root word, rapha, resh fe he, means to weaken. And what I see is in these two terms pronounced identically. Something is weakened, but the being weakened lends to it being healed or mended. In other words, there's no need to heal it if it's not weak. So they're related terms. Now, remember that Leah's eyes were weak, but Rachel was stunning. However, Rachel may have been weak, Rapha, in other areas that are not so obvious, because she goes and steals the teraphim of her father. In verse 20, it says that Jacob outwitted Levon the Aramean in that he did not tell him he was leaving. He didn't deceive Levon in the sense that Levon sought to deceive Jacob. It's just that he didn't reveal to Levon or to his sons that, number one, he was aware of their true feelings toward him. He didn't reveal to them the dream he had, and he didn't reveal to them when he was going to leave. In verse 21, so he fled with all that he had and passed over. That term is avar, which you should be familiar with. From that term we get ivri or Hebrew. He passed over the river, and of course the river would be the Euphrates. And he headed in the direction of what would be known as Gilead. Now, Levon learns of Jacob's flight on the third day, which I find very interesting. He pursues him and overtakes him on the seventh day. It would be interesting to know for sure what day Pharaoh learns of Israel's flight and what day he overtakes him. Apparently, when Levon set out to pursue Jacob, it was with the intention of killing him. And he probably would have done it had not God intervened in verse 24 in a dream, warning Levon not to speak good or bad to Jacob, indicating that Levon was not to entice him to return with nice words. It was not to threaten him to return with bad words. And before, God had intervened on behalf of Abraham in a dream with Abimelech. And it says in verse 26 through 29, and Levon said to Jacob, he's overtook him now, what have you done that you have tricked me and driven away my daughters like captives of the sword? Why did you flee secretly and trick me and did not tell me, so that I might have sent you away with mirth and songs, with tambourine and lyre, or a big party, in other words? And why did you not permit me to kiss my sons and my daughters farewell? Now you have done foolishly. It is in my power to do you harm. But the God of your father spoke to me last night, saying, be careful not to say anything to Jacob, either good or bad. And so Levon, who has taken advantage of Jacob all these years, acts as if Jacob has hurt his feelings. And so he's acting like the injured father. He's accusing Jacob of wrongdoing. And he refers to Jacob's wives as my daughters, and to Jacob's sons as my sons. And so what this tells us is that Jacob, Israel, must suffer many accusations, unfair and unreasonable accusations, at the hand of the wicked. He also goes on to hint to Jacob that I would have killed you if it were not for your God. Because apparently he pursued Jacob with a great number of people. Interestingly, after this encounter, Jacob is going to encounter Esau, who also comes with a great number of people. But in verse 30, Levon says, seeing that you wish to return to your father's house, it's obvious that you want to return. Why did you find it necessary to steal my gods? So Jacob first explains his departure and the reason for his leaving when Levon was away, because he was afraid, and I think justifiably so, that Levon would withhold his daughters and his sons by force. But when it comes to stealing his gods, he says, whoever among us has your gods shall not live. And so unbeknownst to him, he pronounces a curse on his wife. He pronounced a curse upon the guilty. Basically, he was saying that if you find your gods with somebody, you're permitted to do to that person whatever you wish. But he didn't know that Rachel was the one. And so, interestingly, she's going to die very soon thereafter. Verse 34 says that Rachel had taken the teraphim and put them in the saddle of the camel. That was to prevent Laban from searching there as he looked for his gods, because she said to him, "I'm not going to get up because the manner of women is upon me." That would give her an excuse and he wouldn't look there. Now, was that true or was she deceiving him? It doesn't say. Now, perhaps Laban was using the gods as an excuse to search through all of Jacob's stuff. And because that probably was the case, in verse 36, we see that after Laban has gone on this search and come up with nothing, that Jacob was angry and he strove with Laban. He had looked through all of his things. And he challenges Laban to place all of the stolen goods, which there were none, in the open for all to see. And he reminds Laban that in all the 20 years of service, I had never taken one thing from you. Jacob went above and beyond to make sure that there could be no accusation railed against him, because Jacob does not want to be perceived as an accuser, as a supplanter, as a trickster, and a deceiver. In other words, he was telling Laban that your accusations are unjustified, and you know they're unjustified. Verse 41, he says, "I served you 14 years for your daughters and 6 years for your flock." And so in saying that, he alludes to Laban's deceit. Because see, Jacob would have only served him 7 years for a wife if Laban had not changed his wage, if he had not deceived him. And Laban had changed his wages throughout that time, multiple times. Now, here's a question. Seeing that he says, "I served 14 years for your daughters, 6 years for your flock," does that insinuate that Jacob's trouble is more than 7 years? I don't know. It's just a question. But what we do see is this. Jacob's trouble seems to be a time of blessing, even in the face of being harassed, accused, and deceived. In verse 42, Jacob says, "If the God of my father, the God of Abraham, and the fear of Isaac had not been on my side, surely now you would have sent me away empty-handed. But God saw my affliction and the labor of my hands and rebuked you last night." Now, when he says fear of Isaac, that is said to refer to the dread that Isaac felt on the altar in Genesis 22 when Abraham took him up to the top of the mountain. The Hebrew word dread or fear is pachad, and it means the fear of an impending danger, because Isaac upon that altar no doubt feared what was coming, but at the last minute or right on time, he was delivered by God. Now, when this accusation is made, notice that Laban makes no attempt to refute what Jacob is claiming, but then turns around and makes this unbelievable statement. He says in verse 43, "The daughters are my daughters, the children are my children, the flocks are my flocks, and all that you see is mine. But what can I do this day for these my daughters, or for their children whom they have born?" So is he, in the face of what Jacob is accusing him of, is in an attempt to save face before all of his other sons and all of the other people who are with him? Perhaps. But nonetheless, before he's played the martyr, "You left, I would have sent you off with a party," all this kind of stuff. But now in this statement, he reveals his true feelings. He is now insisting that everything is his, in spite of the fact that Jacob did work 14 years for the wives and did work 6 years for the flocks. And that was the agreement. And so in doing this, Laban is reminiscent of the herdsmen of Gerar who were claiming the water from the wells that had been dug by Isaac. In other words, Isaac did all the work, but the herdsmen of Gerar were claiming all the blessings. That's exactly what Laban is doing here, which if you think about it in terms of what's going on in the modern world, the Syrians of today, they claim the Golan is ours. It's ours. You've done all the work, but it really belongs to us. Now, in verse 44, after all of this, Laban says then, "Come and let us make a covenant between you and me." And verse 45, responding to this, Jacob took a stone. Now, it's very clear it is a stone, not the stone. And he set it up as a pillar. And verse 46, he had his servants gather stones, and make a heap. And that word heap in Hebrew is gal, gimel lamed. And once they make this heap of stones, they all ate there at the heap. They had this covenantal meal. And in verse 47, both parties referred to it as the heap of witness. Galid. Gimel Lamed Ein Dalit. Galid. Also known as Gilead. Because Ad means witness, Gal means heap. But it's the place called Gilead. Now here's what's very interesting to me anyway about this. Gilead is where Elijah will come from. And Elijah is one of the two witnesses. We see him in Matthew 17 on the top of Mount Transfiguration. We believe he's one of the two witnesses. And Elijah in the future is traditionally, anyway, supposed to come at a time when you eat a covenantal meal, that is Passover. And when he comes, he's declaring the Messiah. So this is the area that all this is taking place. Verse 46, it says that Jacob had his brethren. Now, who were his brethren? That was his sons. He had his sons gather stones. Elijah, who comes from Gilead, in 1 Kings 18, verse 31, what does he do? He gathers stones. That is, he takes the 12 stones representing the 12 tribes of Israel, and he repairs the altar of God that had been broken down. I find that very interesting. The place, not the heap, but the place that this occurred was also called Mizpah, which is a watch post. Because it says, Levan says, the Lord watch, and that root is Tzapha. The Lord watch between you and me when we are out of one another's sight. If you oppress my daughters, or if you take wives besides my daughters. An interesting statement. Although no one is with us, see, God is witness between you and me. So there's a second part of this. They made the heap of stones, Gilead. They ate the covenantal meal, but they call the place Mizpah, or a watch post. So Tzapha, the root, where it says the Lord watch, that is the same word that's used for watchman in Ezekiel 33. And it's interesting to me that this place that is a watch post is also the home of Elijah, who is the witness. And so prophetically, in my opinion, this links the spirit of Elijah with the watchman. The watchman has the spirit of Elijah. The spirit of Elijah is to return the people to God into his Torah before the great and dreadful day of the Lord. And if the great and dreadful day of the Lord is coming, if you see the sword coming upon the land, what is the watchman to do? I find it also interesting that Levan warns that God is watching if you take strange wives. That's the terminology I will use. Wives besides my daughters, but if you will, strange wives. Because why did Jacob go to Padan Aram? To find a wife. Why? Because Isaac did not want him marrying the women of the land of Canaan. He didn't want him taking strange wives. And so Levan says that this is going to be a watchtower representing the fact that God is going to watch over, and if you take strange wives, God is watching. Verse 52, Levan says, I will not pass over this heap, and you will not pass over to do the other harm. So now earlier, Levan pretended to be concerned about his daughter's welfare, but now it becomes clear that his real intent is to protect himself from Jacob through this covenant, because Jacob has God with him. And so even though they could cross this place for peaceful purposes, the idea was we don't cross this spot to do the other harm. And so to kind of cement this, in verse 53, Levan invokes the God of Nahor and the God of Abraham, but Jacob only swears by the fear of his father Isaac, not by the God of Nahor, indicating, number one, I'm not going to mix these two. Number two, the ties that we've had with the relatives in the Haran, which are in Syria, that's severed. We don't think the way you think. We don't act the way you act. We don't live the way you live. And so as we move into chapter 32, verse 1, it says, in the morning, Levan rose, he kissed his daughters and sons, and he blessed them, and then he departed and went his way. In verse 2, Jacob also departed, and he went his way, and the angels of God met him. Why did they meet him? Perhaps they were sent to protect him because Later on, he's going to have to encounter Esau. And remember, Esau had wanted to kill him too. Then Jacob says, this is God's camp, and he called it Mahanaim, which is literally two camps. And so when it says two camps, what is it referring to? Some say angelic camps. There was one angelic camp that had accompanied Jacob all the while that he was outside the land. And now as he's preparing to go in the land, there's this other camp that are coming to meet him to escort him into the land. It is interesting that apparently he is the only one to see them, which then hints at the angels that he saw on the staircase who were ascending and descending. In fact, the Hebrew wording when he sees them suggests that he recognized them. Maybe the two camps refers to his camp and then the angelic camp. I don't know for sure, but here's what I find interesting as we come to the end of this Torah portion. This is occurring in Gilead, where Elijah's from. And what does Elijah play a role in? According to Matthew 17, the Messiah says that Elijah will come and restore all things. And what is the restoration of all things? It's bringing the two camps together as one. Ultimately, this is going to happen under the kingship of the Messiah. It is Messiah Yeshua who will accomplish this. Why? Because he is the stone watching over the heads. And with that, we say shalom.
Like what you're hearing? Become a BillCloud Premium Partner to watch or listen to hundreds of hours of teachings and resources on demand. Go to BillCloud.com/subscribe to start watching today.